When I was in my internship, I felt super fortunate that I got to cover a burn unit. And on top of that, I was assigned a burn case study. That meant I had to spend more time in that unit. I talk more about this in episode 22, where I cover ebb and flow. One of the things that stood out in the burn unit more than any other unit was the smell. Burning flesh has a really strong and unique smell. And our senses are super powerful. They can bring back memories, both good and bad. And when I took a clinical job, I wasn't prepared for all the pressure injuries I'd be seeing. When I first worked in clinical, pressure injuries were called pressure ulcers, and people were still using the term bed sores. I'm sure you'll still find people using that term today, but the terminology has changed. We now call them pressure injuries, and like I mentioned with the smell of burning flesh in the burn unit, pressure injuries have a distinct smell. And when they're big, open, and non-healing, you can often smell the wound down the hall. When I think about it, it's kind of crazy I ended up in a trauma unit, or in a hospital at all for that matter. In my internship, the ICU gave me anxiety. It's weird how you can handle some things more than others, and how you never know where your path will take you. A lot of things I saw in the trauma unit, such as people with open abdomens after being shot, was not that hard for me to see. But I never did well with images of pressure injuries, especially stage 4 pressure injuries. Those go all the way through the skin, tissue, muscle, and often have visible bone. I always struggled with that and still do. The good news, if you're listening to this thinking, yep, I don't do well with that either, is that as a dietitian, you really don't need to observe or even look at the pressure injuries. You do, however, have a huge role in the treatment and management of pressure injuries, so you need to make sure you address them as part of your intervention and document skin very clearly in your assessments. The management of pressure injuries takes an interdisciplinary approach where everyone plays a role in the care of these patients. I'm Jana Nickel, and this is the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. Hey there, this episode is about pressure injuries, which is a great topic. You need to know about these and how to prevent them. Also, I want you to know how essential your role is as a dietitian working with people who are at risk of developing pressure injuries. There's a lot to cover in this episode, and I have a story for you at the end that ties a lot of concepts together, so be sure to listen to the end. But before we get started, 2 new RDs have joined this fabulous community. First, Diana Haberberger passed the exam. Diana was super dedicated. She kept me in the loop along her journey, and she's a living example of what happens when you keep going one foot in front of the other. Congratulations, Diana. You earned this, and I'm so happy for you. And I also want to give a shout out to Emily Reiser, who listened to almost every episode and just passed the RD exam. She reached out when she passed the exam to let me know, which fills my cup, so I can celebrate her on this podcast. Congratulations, Emily. I'm excited to see what these amazing new RDs do with their career. Emily and Diana can now proudly call themselves registered dietitians or registered dietitian nutritionists, whatever sounds the best to you. Either one has a great ring to it. And I want to take a minute to let you know that you never know someone's journey. Everyone passes the exam on their own terms. If you're feeling nervous about the exam, try to do something that keeps you grounded and focused on what you're working towards. Sometimes people hold back from taking the exam out of fear. If that's you, I get it. Fear is a real emotion, and it very much can hold you back. But I want you to know it's not the exam, it's the fear of the outcome. Fear is a big emotion for me, and I've let it control so much of my life. So I'm speaking from experience. And I'm speaking from a place where it's still something I work on. But having that awareness and giving space for that fear while also working to not let it control me has helped me so much. Pema Chodron is someone I adore and admire. In one of her books, When Things Fall Apart, she shares a story about a friend who had this recurring nightmare where she was chased by these horrible monsters. Doors couldn't keep the monsters away. She'd shut doors to keep them from getting to her, but they'd break through the door. Pema asked this friend what the monsters looked like, and the friend said she didn't know because she never looked at them or faced them. She didn't want to see the terrifying monsters. The next time the friend had the recurring nightmare, she was doing all the same things: running, opening doors, and preparing to shut the door behind her to protect herself from the monsters. But something changed in that recurring nightmare. She decided that she would stop, turn around, and face the monsters. She looked them straight in the eye. And yeah, they were big, scary, and just as awful as she imagined. But they didn't attack her. Instead, they jumped up and down and eventually started to disappear. And in time, they vanished. Pema's friend never had the nightmare again. When I first heard this story, I had goosebumps. In fact, in all honesty, I shed a few tears because at the time in my life, I was going through some real stuff. But this story resonated so much with me. And the truth is, you can apply this story to any scenario in your life where fear is holding you back. Since the goal of this podcast is to help you get across the finish line and pass the RD exam, think about how fear might be holding you back from scheduling your exam. If you've taken the time to study, you've put in the effort, but fear's holding you back, I want you to schedule the exam. The truth is, you can ask anyone who's taken and passed the exam what it's like. But remember, that's their experience. They're not you. You are uniquely you. You'll never know what it's really like until you experience it yourself. So here's my word of advice for you today. If you're feeling afraid and doubting your ability to pass the exam, schedule it and give it a try. Face the fear and see what happens. I really hope this story helps you like it helped me that day when I first heard it. Okay, so I'm going to change gears now and talk about pressure injuries. Like I mentioned, you might still hear pressure ulcers or bed sores, but the correct terminology as of the time of this recording is pressure injuries. Things keep changing, so who knows what the name will change to if it changes again in the future. You might also hear the term HAPPY. Not happy, H-A-P-P-Y, but HAPPY, H-A-P-I, which is the abbreviation for hospital-acquired pressure injury. So if you overhear someone talking about a pressure injury, or maybe you see it used in the medical record, it means the pressure injury developed when the patient was in the hospital. So you may be asked a question or two about pressure injuries on the exam. And if not, this is a topic that's really important because they pretty much guide my interventions. So let me clarify what I mean by that. Pressure injuries are extremely costly. They cost medical centers and organizations millions of dollars a year. But more than the financial cost, it's a huge cost to the patient. Pressure injuries have a huge negative impact on people's health. So we want to make sure we take care of the skin and always address skin in our assessments as dietitians. And if there's a pressure injury, you need to take that into consideration when calculating the estimated nutrient needs for that patient. Malnutrition is a hot topic, and I've talked about it in other episodes. The reality is a lot of people are malnourished. And you can't always just look at someone and determine they're well-nourished or not. This is why dietitians do nutrition-focused physical exams, or NFPEs, to determine the presence of malnutrition, and if so, the severity of malnutrition. Malnutrition's a contributing factor for developing pressure injuries. So So catching these high-risk patients and providing recommendations on how to improve their nutritional status is huge in preventing pressure injuries. It's something healthcare workers and facilities are monitoring, and around 12 to 50% of hospitalized patients have malnutrition. And this further increases the risk of pressure injuries. When I first started working in clinical, I'd hear healthcare workers make comments such as, "The person is NPO, but they have obesity, so we don't have to start nutrition yet." I'd have to intervene and correct these false beliefs because science has shown that a lot of patients with obesity are malnourished. So they need nutrition intervention, especially if they have other risk factors for developing pressure injuries. BMI, for example, is a risk factor for pressure injuries. So for people with an underweight BMI, which means their BMI is less than 18.5, or a BMI of greater than 30, which means their BMI is in the obese range, they have an increased risk of developing pressure injuries. Especially when other risk factors are present, such as immobility, older age, poor blood sugar control, friction, poor perfusion, incontinence, and poor nutrition. I mentioned a little earlier how pressure injuries guide my interventions. What I mean by that is that if a patient has a lot going on, say they have diabetes, kidney failure, and a stage 3 pressure injury, I usually make sure I'm giving enough nutrition to help heal the pressure injury, or at least prevent it from getting worse. Sometimes it's hard and we take things case by case, but I always make sure I talk about it with the team and that the pressure injury is at the forefront of my thoughts and recommendations. Screening for these patients is critical. I talked about nutrition screening tools in episode 6. We use these tools to identify at-risk patients. So on top of using screening tools, such as the malnutrition screening tool, or MST, we also screen for pressure injuries. Many places will have a consult that triggers the dietitian if the patient's admitted with a pressure injury. And ideally, there's good communication between the wound care team and dietitians. One more thing I want to mention before I go into the MNT, or medical nutrition therapy for pressure injuries, is the staging of wounds. As a dietitian, I don't stage pressure injuries, and neither will you. So I'm not going to go into that. But what I do want to mention is that there are different stages. The stages are 1, 2, 3, 4, unstageable, and deep tissue injury. If a stage 3 or 4 pressure injury develops in the hospital, these are reportable to CMS and could impact reimbursement for the care and treatment of that pressure injury. As a reminder, CMS stands for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. One more thing. Pressure injuries of the lower extremities are common and can be so debilitating. It causes a lot of pain and discomfort. It can lead to amputations, which further impacts mobility, and can lead to increased morbidity, pain, and even economic burden. When people are sick, in pain, and they can't move, that means they also have a hard time working, which affects their lifestyle. So these wounds of the lower extremities are so important to be aware of, and at-risk people should be educated about the risks and importance of self-care, especially people with diabetes. Diabetes, when not under good control, increases the risk of diabetic foot ulcers, which is why good nutrition and blood sugar control is so critical. So let's go over the MNT for pressure injuries because, as you know, nutrition is awesome and oh so important. I'm going to start with calories because in our notes, we estimate nutrient needs and calories is one of the first things we assess. It's recommended people with pressure injuries get 30 to 35 calories per kilo. This needs to be adjusted for weight, so if someone is underweight, you may need to give a little more. And if they're overweight, they may need a little less. So don't go out there and give everyone 30 to 35 calories per kilo. This is a range that we use as a starting point. You have to consider other things going on with a patient, and you have to consider other conditions someone might have going on with them. And I'm going to use a term that I know can be really hard for new dietitians and dietetic interns. That term is using your clinical judgment. You really need to use clinical judgment. And it can be hard when you haven't done clinical and you're not used to it, but I promise you, it will get easier with time. The point is, calories are important. When you give enough calories, you prevent the body from breaking down its own stores, particularly protein stores, which is not good when you're dealing with a pressure injury. Protein is needed for wound healing, so the last thing you want is for the body to break down protein. So you need to give enough calories and nutrient-dense calories to help with healing. The goal is to provide high-calorie, high-protein food. People should get their nutrition from food, but it's not always possible. If someone isn't meeting their needs through food, then an oral nutrition supplement might be needed. Something you can try too is to liberalize the diet. This requires active discussions, but sometimes in the hospital setting, people won't eat the food, especially if they're on a therapeutic diet. Here's an example. I've often seen consistent carbohydrate, renal, low-fat diets ordered for some patients. So if they're not eating anything, one of the recommendations is to consider liberalizing the diet a little so that they're more familiar with the foods that they can get and it will help increase their calorie and nutrient intake. It doesn't make much sense to restrict the diet if someone's not eating anyways. Remember, food is medicine and food helps heal. So the goal is to help the person eat and get better so they can go home. Since I mentioned protein, let's move on to protein. The recommendation is to give 1.25 to 1.5 grams per kilo body weight. Again, the goal is to give high protein foods, but it can sometimes be challenging. So in those cases, supplementing with a protein supplement might be necessary. And I want to mention that just because you give an oral nutrition supplement doesn't mean it's forever. Once the patient improves, or maybe they start feeling better and start eating better, they might not need the supplement anymore. So if that happens, recommend discontinuing the supplement. This is why dietitians reassess our patients. For stage 3 and stage 4 pressure injuries, research shows that arginine supplementation may be helpful, as well as other micronutrients, which I'll talk about in a minute. But first, I want to talk about fluid because fluid intake matters and fluid is needed in large amounts. Larger amounts than micronutrients are needed. When the skin is dry, it's harder to heal. You want patients to be well hydrated, if possible. As you know, some conditions such as heart and kidney failure can impact fluid, but at the very least, I want it to be on your mind. So at least think about the fluid your patient is getting and the amount of fluid they need in order to not only treat the pressure injury, but to also prevent it. I like to think about when I go to elevation, my skin gets so dry, and if I don't moisturize it enough, my fingers start to crack. That analogy helps me when I think about pressure injuries. Another thing to keep in mind is that whenever there's an open wound, fluid is lost. The amount of body fluid loss can vary. Some people might also need a wound vac, which you can easily see how much fluid is draining from the wound. So these are important concepts to keep in mind. And I recommend asking questions when you're not sure. I don't know about you, but it doesn't feel good to me when I'm uncertain about something. In those moments, though, that's when I believe you have the most growth. And the way to grow is to ask. Ask questions. You don't need to do this alone. Reach out to someone who might know the answer. And if there's no one to ask, do some research. And remember that whatever decision you make in your recommendations, follow up and change the recommendations or nutrition therapy if you need to. That's why I said we reassess patients all the time. It's okay to change your recommendation. I still ask questions all the time, and I can't tell you how many times I've had to make changes to my recommendations. And I still look things up. So don't be afraid to take on new challenges. Okay, I promised I'd discuss micronutrients, so here we go. Eating a well-balanced diet, as you know, with a variety of foods, makes sure the body gets important nutrients, including micronutrients. So this is and should be our go-to intervention. But some micronutrients are needed in larger doses or need a little bit of attention when it comes to pressure injuries. Vitamin E, for example, is responsible for collagen synthesis. And collagen is really important for skin integrity, so making sure adequate vitamin E is provided in the diet is a good idea. Zinc is a cofactor for collagen and protein synthesis. I just reviewed the range of protein someone needs with a pressure injury, so make sure there's enough zinc in the diet or in the intervention you're recommending. Keep in mind that zinc is lost in the body fluids, so if the pressure injury is oozing fluid, that fluid contains zinc, so supplementation might be necessary. Again, case-by-case situation. Look at your patient, talk to the doctors, talk to the team, and then make your recommendations based on what you see. Keep in mind that zinc interferes with copper absorption, so if someone is getting zinc supplementation, you need to monitor the patient for potential copper deficiency. Okay, so let's talk about iron. Iron helps oxygen delivery. Remember I mentioned how poor perfusion is a risk factor for developing a pressure injury? Well, making sure someone isn't deficient in iron helps oxygen transport and tissue perfusion. So important for our skin. So what can you do then as a dietitian? Well, you want to make sure nutritional intake is adequate, that they're getting enough calories, protein, and fluid to meet their estimated needs. And remember, everyone's needs vary, which is why we do individual assessments. You want to consider providing a supplement if the patient can't meet their nutrient needs from the diet alone. And be sure to assess the DRIs of important micronutrients such as vitamin C and E, as well as vitamin A and K, because they help promote skin integrity and healing. And making sure their required intake is met. That's really important. At least try to meet their estimated nutrient needs. And lastly, iron, zinc, and copper are also important micronutrients you should have on your radar. It doesn't mean these all need to be supplemented separately. A lot of the times it's met by their diet if they're eating enough. But the point is, make sure you're keeping these micronutrients in mind, and if they're not getting enough, that you take that into consideration when making your recommendations. So before I wrap up this episode, I want to share a story. This is a personal story, but it shows how health conditions can have a compounding impact on our lives. This is the story of my Uncle Steve. Uncle Steve was fun. He drove a purple car, which I thought was so cool as a kid, and he loved to travel. My aunt and him went to Mexico and Las Vegas all the time, and he really just lived his life. I remember one Christmas, Uncle Steve didn't look good. He was at the table, pretty pale, and had no energy. I was around 13 years old at the time, so I knew something wasn't right with him, but was busy with my cousins and all the Christmas chaos to really understand what was going on. And also, Uncle Steve loved to party, so you often saw him with a cigarette and an alcoholic beverage of some sort in his hands. But on that Christmas, he wasn't drinking anything, which was kind of weird. Well, turns out at 34 years old, Uncle Steve was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. For years after that, he'd talk to me about it and how this diagnosis cut his life in half. And I'd tell him it didn't have to be that way, but for him, it had a big impact on his lifestyle. And in all honesty, he didn't really let it affect his life. Besides taking insulin, he really didn't change anything else. He still smoked and drank and ate what he wanted and would cover the carbs he ate with insulin. He didn't eat a lot of sweets and he definitely cut that out of his diet, so he would turn those down. But besides that, not much was different. As a kid, it's funny how you remember certain things, but I just remember being fascinated when he'd inject himself with insulin. Shots never scared me, so I was really curious. The needle was really cool. It looked like a pen, and his was black with a little turquoise on it. When I decided to become a dietitian, and full transparency, my family history of diabetes really had zero influence on me becoming a dietitian. Not that I didn't care. I did care, and I do care about my family. It just didn't influence my career path. But as I learned more about diabetes management, I'd ask him about his lifestyle and what he was doing to stay healthy. Now, I didn't see my Uncle Steve a lot because I was in the United States and he was in Canada. Anytime he'd go to Vegas, if I was free, I'd drive over to visit him and my aunt. And of course, whenever I went home, I'd see him, but it's not like I saw him all the time. So naturally, I'd ask him about his health when I saw him. One Christmas, he got so irritated with me because I asked him what his hemoglobin A1C level was. He said to me, "I hate dietitians. They always ask me about my eating and tell me to stop drinking and stop smoking." Now, I share this with you because it's so hard as a family member to see someone suffering with a condition that's robbing them of their health. He didn't mean it when he snapped at me, and he apologized. We talked through it, so it was all good in the end. But I did decide from that point on, I'd be there for him if he had questions or needed it, but I wouldn't pry or ask about his diabetes anymore. I decided to be his niece and not his dietitian because, as we learn from motivational interviewing and the stages of change, he was not ready to change. And no matter what I said, he wasn't going to change his views or stance at that time. So I stopped and chose to enjoy my limited time with him. As you might already be guessing, things didn't go so well. He went to Mexico one time with my aunt and had a massive heart attack right when he got there. He didn't want to seek treatment and waited an entire week before he got treatment when they finally got back to Canada. He had heart surgery right away and was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney failure. He started on peritoneal dialysis, which he did at home, so that was great. At this point, he quit smoking and drinking, and he did reach out to me with questions about his diet, especially about what he should or shouldn't be eating while getting peritoneal dialysis. My Uncle Steve ended up having issues with his feet, one foot in particular, which is a big deal, especially for people with diabetes. If you've ever been to an endocrinologist's office or clinic, at least the ones I've been to, there's pamphlets and posters about foot health with diabetes. Because, like I mentioned a little earlier, diabetes is a risk factor for wounds in the lower extremities. Remember, one of the risk factors of wounds is poor perfusion. Well, prolonged diabetes can cause poor perfusion, especially if blood sugars aren't well controlled. And that's unfortunately what happened with my Uncle Steve. He was also diagnosed with a terminal lung disease, which was completely separate from his diabetes. So his body was failing him. He didn't want to be an amputee, so he refused amputation and eventually passed away. I share this story because Uncle Steve was so loved and also because his story is not that uncommon. The complications he had happens to so many people. Diabetes can lead to heart disease and kidney disease. It happened to Uncle Steve. Diabetes increases the risk of heart disease. It happened to Uncle Steve. Over time, diabetes can cause diabetic foot wounds. It happened to Uncle Steve. And no matter who it is, they have to be ready to change and to take the steps to make that change. I was upset when he brushed me off because I loved him so much and wanted the best for him. But it's not where he was, so I had to meet him where he was and just be the niece he needed. The takeaway from this episode, at least what I hope you get from it, is a deeper knowledge of pressure injuries and the importance of skin integrity, as well as how big your role is as a dietitian. Your recommendations make a difference. Of course, there's other factors involved that are outside your control when it comes to pressure injuries. Being diligent about skin and providing appropriate nutrition recommendations are within your control, and it matters. And if you have an Uncle Steve in your life who resists your help, remember that helping sometimes simply means asking how you can support them. It can look different to different people. So on that note, keep going, keep moving forward, believe in yourself and what you're here to do. And as the amazing Brené Brown says, talk to yourself like you would someone you love. So be kind to yourself. Your mindset and thoughts are so powerful. Put your mind in the right place and you'll get across the finish line. I know you will. Stay on top of your study game. There's no limits to achieving the success you so deeply desire. Until next time.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and leave a review. Share this episode on Instagram at JanaNicoleRD and help spread the word to other RDs to be. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time on the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. Bye for now.